once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English stead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, with another exciting episode of the second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And as you heard, if you're listening to the music very carefully, not only had I misplaced the CD with the bagpipes on it early in the program, I also obviously misplaced a small part of my brain, so that I started the wrong music first, but that's all right. If today is the 27th and it is Saturday and it is 2014, you're welcome to give us a call in here at 773-1400 or 1-866-597-1400. In answer to the gentleman who called last hour, that 1.2% rise in inflation, that 1.2% annualized rate of inflation for the third quarter was based on the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, sometimes known as the PCE. We traditionally have used the CPI, which is a different animal. The PCE is the one that, it means Personal Consumption Expenditures, and it is basically a survey done by the Bureau of Economic Analysis across the country. First, they do a survey and said, what percentage of your money are you spending on these items? And they've done extensive work on that. Say, okay, this is a percentage that you're spending on food. This is your percentage you're spending on food away from home, alcoholic beverages, rent, owner's equivalent rent, which is the weirdest thing in the CPI and the PCE, housing, apparel, medical care, transportation, and so on. So they get a national average of what percentage of our income we spend on each of those items, and then they come into those and plot the prices of those items each quarter very carefully. Actually, they do it monthly, and then they do it again for the quarter. Then they revise it for the next several months until they finally get it right, so that and they go through and do lots of calculations on it over a period of years. So since 2009, the PCE has been the best, in my opinion, indicator of what's actually going on in prices that individuals face day to day. It doesn't count what the businesses pay for things. It doesn't count a lot of things that are in the Consumer Price Index. What it counts is literally what you spend your money on, and based on the percentage of your money that you spend. And it gets sort of weird when you factor that in, because that means if you're putting money into a 401k, or you're putting money into a 403b, or you put your savings in the bank, that's not counted as part of the calculation. It's a very complex thing. But anyway, the third quarter, the PCE, the actual consumer personal expenses, personal consumption expenditures in the United States, the cost of that rose 1.2%. And I strongly suspect the PCE for the fourth quarter will be much lower. This is what I mean by the effect of inflation, the effect of the price of fuel. Because what's happening is we've had a very substantial decline in the price of fuel, just that simply. Gasoline, for example, is 4.2% of 5.3% in this case of the PCE. It was adjusted up when they do the calculations to 6.5. Well, that's a pretty good size piece of the action. As I said earlier, the biggest piece out there, food and beverages are the second largest at 17%, and they measure not only food consumed at home, but food away from home. And the average American, it turns out, spends about 6% of their income on food away from home. And that would include the McDonald's biscuit that the gentleman who called a few minutes ago was referring to. We spend 8.7% of our money on food at home, which, by the way, is an interesting thing. Around the world, somewhere between a third and half of the earnings of the average person around the world is spent on food. In the United States of America, we have a really interesting number. Ours is 17%, but we only spend 8.7% of that, of our income, on food that we consume at home. We spend almost as much money, 6%, eating out, which is, in the rest of the world, considered to be a luxury. We're actually in pretty good shape. Our big number in the United States is housing. That's about 33%. About a third of what we spend in the United States as consumers, now not as the whole nation, not as businesses, not as corporations, is on housing. We spend 17% on food. We spend 5% on clothing, 5% on medical care, 17% on transportation, and it goes down the line. Recreation, 8.4%. So it's really, to me, a fascinating set of numbers to look at, just because they reveal so much about how wealthy we are as a nation. By the way, one of the issues the caller mentioned, that the COLA increases. One of the issues that we faced back when we had double-digit inflation is the COLA, the cost of living increases that were automatic for people, were one of the causes of high inflation. And the reason they were is, if last year we had 10% inflation and towards the end of the year the Federal Reserve and whatever else managed to start getting it pushed down, the cost of living increase for the following year would be 10%, which would cause people to have a lot of extra money to spend, which would exacerbate inflation. So the higher inflation got in any given year, the more money was given to people who had COLA increases in the following year, which caused inflation to get worse in each consecutive year as time went by. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. This is the same gentleman from last hour.
And I did say you were a gentleman.
Very few people call me gentleman.
Well, I will today, because you seem to be a gentleman.
Okay. I just want to start your last hour off and be the last hour of your of this year, the last hour you'll have on your program for this year.
Right.
I just wanted to thank you for the last year, for the entertainment, the humor, and most of all, of course, the information. And I've listened to every program as rigorously as I can. And you've been very helpful at times. I spoke to you earlier this year about you spoke positively of AT&T at one point. I know you do not recommend individual stocks, but based on that, I did buy through dividends and the stock price increase, I made money there. So your program is very, very informative. It's very helpful. I also enjoy it, like I said, just for the entertainment, the history classes, the history lessons you give, your grasp of world knowledge and everything has just been really entertaining.
Now, on top of all of that, we're funny looking.
You often talk about people not listening or whether somebody's listening. I'm sure there's a lot of people listening. I want to challenge the other people that are listening here for the last hour of your program this year. How about other people that listen? Just call in, tell Jake and Jeff how much you enjoy the program, and maybe what you enjoy about it. But if nothing else, just how much you do enjoy the program and that you do listen. And with that, I wish you both Merry Christmas is over with, but I wish you a Happy New Year.
All right.
Hopefully all your predictions for next year have come true, because they sound pretty positive.
Well, I wish you a prosperous and very successful, by your definition of success, 2015.
All right, thank you.
Thanks
for the call. You know, and that is important. Suffice to say that from a financial point of view, an economic point of view, we don't have to do this show.
Yeah, that's...
We are really, really picky about who we take as clients, and we've reached that wonderful position where we're doing really quite well. And why do we keep doing the show? Honestly, we keep doing the show because we think we're doing some good.
We've got another caller on 773-1400.
We do. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to call in and thank you for your show, your program. I do listen to it every week, as many times as I can, as far as, you know, my work allows me. But I just want to wish you a Happy New Year.
Well, I wish
you
a very prosperous New Year, and I hope that all of our predictions come through for you. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Well, not all of them. Not all of them. The Russian, just, the war with Russia.
The good ones.
Skip that
the
one.
Nice prediction.
Oh. I know you're going to talk about Lacker.
I want to talk about Lacker, about Bitcoins, about Lizard Squad.
Okay, you got
all kinds of
I got
stuff.
Some
go
stuff
ahead.
To talk about.
Go ahead.
Me? No. Yeah. You sure?
Yeah,
no,
go
okay.
ahead. Good.
There was a really good paper, if I can find it here, that came out about the difference in income levels. Oh, here it is. The difference in the rich and the upper middle class and everybody else. They have more money, yeah. But how do they get more money? And it, the reason I really like this paper, Edward Wolff, W-O-L-F-F, an economist at New York University, studies wealth distribution. Well, wealth distribution sounds like, well, there's going to be communists here. What he did is discover something that I personally have observed in the 30-some years that I have been observing people investing and making money. The truly wealthy, the top 1% of the nation, 47% of their wealth is in business equity, functioning business equities. Man, is that ever truth. They have 27% of their money in pension accounts. Their residence constitutes 9% of their net worth. Now, when we drop down to the next 19%, so the top 20% are the people with a lot of money. That's the next 19% are definitely the upper middle class, okay?
Right.
They have 28% of their money tied up in the house. 24% of the money is in business equity and other real estate. 16% in pension funds. 22% in pension funds. I'm sorry. Securities. Well, by the way, the top 1%, 27% in securities, 9% in pension funds. I got that wrong. Securities for the next 19%. 22% of their money. Why am I bringing all this stuff up? Because if you drop down to the middle 60% of the nation, we're not talking about poor people here.
Right.
63% of their wealth is in their house.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with having that much wealth, that large a percentage of the wealth, and people focus on this, in their house, is that it is really, really, really hard to spend that money when you need it, and you're subject to the real estate, a single market. It's called your local real estate market,
right,
which is not the national market. And it can devastate you so easily. And I've seen people who've risen from down towards the bottom end of the middle class or even in the working class who have risen to wealth, financial independence, and they've all had something in common. They have all taken a significant portion of their income and invested in some form of equity, meaning either a business, which is risky, or by really getting serious about their 401ks and their IRAs and their equity investments and just being so steady about that. And I have seen them rise from probably the lower 25% or 30% of income in the United States to the point where today they're able to live very comfortably without working.
Right.
And I've seen that so consistently, where I've seen people who are still working, by the way, who are relatively well-off people, they're still working. They still have to work in their old age. Their money's tied up in their house.
Yeah. This is something that is fascinating to watch, because the fear of debt is very real. And if it's something that drives you, if you're afraid of being in debt, then you're probably doing the right thing by paying off your mortgage as fast as you can. But if you're looking at the mortgage rates, it's low, and you are putting extra money to your house just because that's what you're doing. You're not thinking about it. You're just saying, I just want to get this paid off. And it's not some emotional drive. You're doing yourself a disservice. If you're taking extra money and putting it into your house, I'm not necessarily saying don't. Just take some of that and put it away for the future, because it's really hard to eat the bricks in your house.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, and it's certainly, if you can afford to do it, you have the right to do this. You have the right to do anything you want to with your money. But we see a lot of people who actually impoverish themselves in order to pay off their house.
Right.
In other words, they deplete their IRAs that they rolled over from 401ks or their investments to do an early payoff on a 3% mortgage on their house.
Right. And that's just a horrible idea.
But your house is not going to generate income for you in the future. And one of the things that we have experienced with people who have an ongoing shock when they realize that when their house is paid off, the insurance and taxes still come due every year. And they have to make lump sum withdrawals from their investments. And almost without exception, and I won't say this is 100% of the time, but certainly in the majority of cases where people have enough money invested, they could live on it reasonably comfortably, probably for the rest of their life if their portfolio is well managed. If they decide they're going to do a quick payoff on their mortgage, they're going to double their mortgage payment and pay off their mortgage in 5 years or something like that, 5 years later, when they get that mortgage paid off, they are in a financial crunch that puts them in the position where they really need to go back to work to continue to function. And the reason is they pulled long-term, high return, they liquidated high return investments to pay down a mortgage that was probably, total cost on the mortgage was probably less than inflation.
Yeah. If you look at mortgage rates right now are, what, about 4%?
They've actually declined to closer to 3.
So they're close to 3%. So you've got 3 or 4%, even if you have a 5% mortgage. Even if you have a 6% mortgage, and there aren't that many people out there with a 6% mortgage anymore. You've got a 6% mortgage. You get to deduct your 6% mortgage, which means that it really drops down to about a 4% or 3% mortgage. And if you have a 3% mortgage, you're actually talking about less than inflation. After deduction, the actual cost of your mortgage to you is very small. And this is why I said if it's something that it drives you, if you cannot stand being in debt, if you hate the idea of debt, then you're going to stress yourself out if you don't continue to get out of debt. But that's a pretty rare group of people. And most people are saying, well, yeah, I have a mortgage and yeah, I'm going to be paying it off. I'd like to get out of debt early. It's kind of a nice feeling. I mean, it's part of the American dream to get out of debt, to own your house completely.
You're purchasing something there that makes you feel good, and it's not any different than going out to eat or going on a cruise.
Right, right. You are consuming it.
And
it's not something that will produce an income for you.
And it's hard to explain that. Now, this is one of those things where there is no eternal rule of thumb. If, and I remember this entirely too well, there was a time when we assumed the mortgage on a house to buy the house, one of the first houses I ever, well, as a matter of fact, the first house I ever bought. And we assumed a 10% mortgage.
Yeah.
And the reason we paid extra for the house to get the 10% mortgage that was assumable, and the reason we did that was because 10% was much lower than the going mortgage at the time. Now, if you have an option of either investing money, leaving money invested in the market, or paying off a 10% mortgage, yeah, the 10% mortgage pay down is probably the more advantageous way to approach it.
You should probably do that. Yeah.
But if you have, interestingly enough, by the way, when you have very, very high inflation, the markets generally don't do that well.
Right.
When you have very, very, very low inflation, and that's
where we are right now.
This quarter, if they measure that 1.2% that they measured in the third quarter the same way, we very well may not have any inflation in this quarter. And when you've got near zero inflation and you have very, very low, low mortgage rates, rushing to pay off that mortgage is extremely counterproductive. And I know that it's an emotional thing, but it's important to recognize that when you pay off a very, very, very low interest mortgage, you are making a consumer purchase.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that so many people are capable of doing it and are doing it is one of the reasons mortgage rates are so low.
Right.
And anyway.
Yeah. So let me, you mentioned this in passing last hour.
Did I pass last hour?
You passed last hour.
That's good.
Yes. Lacker, who's a former member of the Federal Reserve Board, just put out a paper saying that quantitative easing may actually have caused deflation. And you said it like it was a mind boggler, but it's something we've been talking about for years. quantitative easing, this is the thing that everyone was yelling, the big heads, the talking heads were yelling that this was going to cause runaway inflation, that they were just printing money. Quantitative easing was the act of the... go ahead.
No, his name is Jeffrey Lacker.
Well, I wasn't going to say his first name.
I think that's important that we mention...
conflict of interest
that,
there.
That we mention the fact his name is Jeffrey M. Lacker.
Yeah, well, let's see that. Conflict of interest. Now you have shared that his name is the same as yours, and people are going to go, well, that's why you agreed with him.
Of course, obviously. Anyway, go ahead.
All right. So quantitative easing was the Federal Reserve going on the open market and buying bonds. So if you held a bond, the Federal Reserve may have purchased it from you when you sold it. What's more, they weren't just buying any bonds. They were buying mortgage-backed securities, the ones that were beat up the most, the ones that were most distressed, as well as U.S. government bonds that were distressed. So if you were selling a bond and you sold it at a massive loss to yourself, the government, or the Federal Reserve, not the government, may have been the one that bought it from you because there was no market for them before that. Nobody was willing to buy them. So the Federal Reserve stepped in and said, well, at least we're going to give you some money for it. And in giving the money to you, you lost money on the deal. The Federal Reserve made a point of only buying distressed mortgage-backed securities. So when it went out and bought them for less than the original value, which really locks in deflation because the money is no longer in your pocket. It locked it in. Now, if you had waited for maturity and the folks that actually paid off your debt, you would have gotten dollar for dollar what you put in plus interest. If they didn't pay off your debt, you would have lost a whole chunk of money. And the thing that's coming out of all of this is that a lot more people paid off their debts than we expected to. And so the Federal Reserve made a lot of money. Well, that seems like that would cancel out the deflation, except that they turn around and they give all of their profits back to the United States government, which just pays off U.S. government debt. So that money didn't get rolled in or goes into new spending.
Yeah, it goes into new spending, yeah.
It's pre-debt.
We're not actually paying off debt.
It's pre-debt. You're paying off pre-debt. So they didn't borrow with the money that they used. They spent it instead.
Right.
Which, when the government spends money, you don't get a whole big multiplier effect. You have a very, very, in some cases, you get a shrinking effect.
Right.
So we locked in deflation there, and doesn't really take a massive paper of great mathematics to say, oh, okay, well, you were buying things that people were selling at a loss. Well, that means there was less money in their hands than there was before. Okay, that's deflation.
Yeah. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Your discussion tied in. I was just going to offer you my little life story. I've always had very low-paying jobs in retail.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, cash was very precious, and for me, debt was okay. I did not adopt Dave Ramsey's philosophy of pay your debt off first. To me, that was wrong, because
then there's a lot of truth in that.
Small
right.
adult pay on my credit cards slowly, while the cash I received would go into my mutual funds.
Right.
Every time I had a Christmas bonus, that $300 is all I had, but it went directly to a mutual fund. And it kept growing and growing and growing. And for me, debt was simply a privilege to get what I wanted over time, slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And the interest rates are all right. That's a privilege. That's the cost of getting what you want now, what you can't afford.
Right.
But the cash that I received, 90% of it I tried to invest. And to make a long, long story short, I created a snowball rolling downhill, and it got bigger and bigger.
Uh-huh.
And I had like $550,000 worth
yep.
from a miserable retail job.
You're completely correct.
And I had
an
inheritance to make it even bigger now, so I'm about $900,000 right now.
You're doing the right thing.
I did all by myself with no job, I mean no decent paying job, and it is possible. It is possible. It's a true real life story.
And you are exactly the kind of person in your story that I was talking about, that we have clients right now who have net worths, invested net worth very similar to yours, and they have not focused on Dave Ramsey, pay your debt off, pay your debt off, pay your debt off. And we, for whatever it's worth. I have to bite my tongue sometimes because people really love Dave Ramsey. But,
and he's got some good things to say, but when it comes right. to certain areas, we disagree with him.
I'm going to be very frank and probably make myself unpopular, so what else is new? Dave Ramsey's solution, commonly in my experience, has been one to lock a person into low income and poverty for the rest of their life.
Yeah, I agree.
And they feel good about being low income poverty for the rest of their life.
They're very disciplined in low income
yes,
poverty.
But your approach of invest first, worry about everything else later, is actually far more scriptural than Dave Ramsey.
Yeah, there's an analogy that I give to clients, and we take pro bono cases sometimes. When the people come in and they've got a lot of credit card debt, they're just huge amounts of credit card debt. If you follow Dave Ramsey's idea, you start paying on the credit card debt, and you do an envelope system, and you pay it all off eventually. The analogy that I like to use is sailing. I do a lot of sailing, or have done a lot of sailing in my life. But skiing, snow skiing, if you've seen America's Funniest Home Videos, you see a ski slope. And it is the easiest of easy ski slopes. And there's a person on the top of the ski slope. And there's nobody on the ski slope except for one person at the bottom, right in the middle. And the person at the top is coming down, and they don't know how to ski very well, and they start screaming, "Oh, no!" You see it happening, and they smack right into that person. If you think about the size, the width of the ski slope, that person standing at the bottom of the ski slope is maybe less than, probably a lot less than 1% of the width. To think of accidentally hitting the one thing you shouldn't hit on the way down, it's statistically improbable. But if you look at the videos and they come out so regularly, it happens so often, people get so locked into what they don't want to do that they concentrate so much on it and they steer themselves to it. If you spend all of your money getting out of debt, then the next time you get flat tires, the next time you have to repair your house, the next time fill in the blank, some emergency happens, you got to go back into debt. If you begin by saving money, and then by investing money, and with discipline, paying your debt off as well, then you're in a position that the next time an emergency happens, you've got safety savings set aside for that. And in the future, you have some money to help you pay off the debt if you need to. You've got an income that could come out of your investments. It's really hard to think that way because it's counterintuitive. Most people want to look at the thing that's scary. Debt is scary.
What we've seen with people who pay off their debts is they promptly create some new ones.
Right.
And it is so difficult not to.
Particularly if they pay them off quickly.
And what we've also seen is the money that you use to pay off your debt early is gone. You cannot get it back.
Well, you can. You just have to get more debt. So I gave you that money. Can I have a loan back for the money that I gave you
before? That's what people do with houses is they invest a lot of money in their house, and then they have to borrow it back from somebody and pay interest on
right.
it, which doesn't make I don't understand
I'm
that.
I'm going to get money out of my house. No, you're getting a loan from someone else.
But the people, when you invest money, and again, it takes a long-term view. When you invest money, I was just thinking about the fact that when I started in this business 30-some years ago, I have watched the Dow Jones Industrial Average rise through 1,000, from below 1,000, crawl up through 1,000. Today, it's 18,000. Admittedly, there's been a lot of inflation, but the dividends pretty much covered inflation during that period. So for every dollar that went in, that you couldn't have done it at the time, but if you had hypothetically put a dollar into the Dow Jones Industrial Average, it'd be $18 a day in real buying power. Whereas money that if I decided to pay off a debt early, and I did several times, the money I put into paying that debt off early is gone. It didn't ever become $18. And
maybe I was saved because I couldn't afford to pay off the debt in one chunk.
That's
or
it.
A whole bunch. I had to do it piecemeal.
And this
but again,
is,
I never thought, you know, you get my valuable dollars as little as I can give you,
mm-hmm.
and then my mutual funds gets the most of my valuable dollars that I can get my hands on.
And
that was the philosophy through a whole lot. I've been investing since 1978.
Yeah, that's...
I've seen the crash of 1987. I saw the so-called the worst crash of all time in 2008, which wasn't true. But you know, it kills me. You guys give me perspective, because when I hear the news media, I realize they have no idea what they're talking about.
And people are focused on the short term.
We don't know a lot about what we're talking about, but at least we have an idea about what we're talking about.
And what we said earlier about paying off your mortgage early, it's a fascinating thing. Paying off your debt early or paying off your mortgage early, as rational as people make it sound, is actually a consumer expenditure. You have bought some feel good. Whereas investing in a good, what I call a mediocre mutual fund. It doesn't have to be the best mutual fund in the world. I actually watched a guy invest in a mediocre mutual fund who never moved from it for many, many, many years. And I tracked it, and then he decided to start market timing and lost a lot of money. Had he just stayed with the mediocre mutual fund, I've tracked over the years where he would have been, and he would have had like three or four times the money he has today. But just investing in a mediocre mutual fund that didn't do all that well compared with maybe some others, over as long as you're talking about, involves two things. One, recognizing that in 2000, as the market tanked and kept tanking and kept tanking and took forever to recover, the level of patience and faith and dedication that you intuitively had is what you got rewarded for. So the big issue is staying away from short-term benefit, clearly visible short-term reward, and having the faith in the United States economy to stay in a widely diversified investment for a long period of time, and you look back and you realize, man, was I smart. And there's an essence to this. This is just Jeff McClure's philosophy here. I don't have a paper to back it up anywhere. But the longer your time horizon, the more successful you're likely to be.
Yeah.
The shorter your time horizon, the less successful. Actually, there are some papers on that. I just can't cite them right here off the top of my head. But basically, the more it was a chicken or egg thing as to whether wealthy people naturally thought about longer time horizons because they were wealthy or because they became wealthy by thinking about longer-term time horizons. And I can tell you that you're an example of why I think it was a matter of the egg came first. You thought about longer-term issues, and you just started putting one foot in front of the other and putting away a certain amount of money every month in your investments, which I firmly believe should be your prime, everybody's prime thing to do. And you wind up financially independent. And the person who carefully paid off their debt 20 or 30 times is a lot like my father's comment about he was an expert on quitting smoking. He quit it every day when he went to bed. And well, he died of emphysema. So,
thank you for the call, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate
and
it.
And have
You're
a
welcome.
Good, have a happy new year.
Happy new year.
I love it when people call about things like that.
We have some commercials to play.
We do?
Yeah.
We have to play commercials?
Town Square needs to get paid.
Okay, we'll play some commercials. You are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure on this, the 27th day of Saturday of 2014. 27th Saturday.
It's 27th Saturday of what? Wait a minute.
This is the Saturday, December 27th.
There we go.
Of the 14th year after the second millennia.
13th year after the second millennia.
14th. Actually, the 15th. But we'll get back to that.
We can talk about that.
I mean, the zeroth was the first, was not the, oh, you're right.
It is the 13th year.
It'd be the 14th year, because the zero doesn't count, but this is one, it's the end of the 14th
year.
We're beginning. Whatever. Yeah. We'll be, and Lord willing, and we don't have a time warp, we'll be back. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone numbers in here have not changed, even though time has progressed and we have been proceeding at 144,000 miles an hour through space. 773-1400 if you're in East Bell County.
Otherwise, 1-866-597-1400 anywhere else within the sounds of our voices.
Funny thing, I don't feel like I'm going 144,000 miles an hour.
Yeah, well, you would notice if you weren't.
I'd notice we stopped.
Yeah, so I think you just, this is the new normal or the old normal or some kind
right.
of normal.
Well, we've been doing that for a rather extended period of time, moving at 144,000 miles an hour, which, by the way, is why all those things about time travel, I think, are so funny.
We are traveling through time, just forward.
Well, the point is, if you go back in time, you know, if you were to go back a year in time and you were to appear at exactly the same spot.
We'd be in space.
You would be, you'd be dead. That's probably why none of the time travel things have ever worked, because people just popped into space and they're gone. Okay, and we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Joe. I'm calling. I have a IRA, which a self-directed IRA, which I rolled in my TSP from the government when I retired.
You've got some good acronyms. I love it.
And unfortunately, based on the pensions which I have, I'm going to turn 70 here in another year, and I'm going to have to start taking my RMD, and it's going to get me for about 28% on the RMD.
28%?
Yep.
No.
That's the taxes or?
The taxes.
Yeah. Oh.
Okay. All right. 28% taxes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. But you don't need to take. Yeah. Okay.
He thought you were. Okay. Let me explain to the listeners what you've just said. You've got great acronyms.
Man, you sound like you're in the business, bud. You know,
Well, I've been studying this for a while.
Okay.
Government employees have something called a thrift savings plan, which is roughly only sort of but kind of similar to a 401k.
good description.
And when retirement happens, you can roll that over into an individual retirement account, IRA. So then when you reach the magical age that the government is the only people besides 3 to 6-year-olds that count your half age. A 3-year-old will say, I'm not 3, I'm 3.5. The government says, you're not 70, you're 70.5 or 59.5. Once you hit 59.5, you can take money out without penalty. When you hit 70.5, the government says you have something called a required minimum distribution, what you just called an RMD. If you don't take that, and they calculate up the required minimum distribution based on a value at the last day of a year prior, and it's a kind of a complex thing. If you don't take it, then you owe as a penalty 50% of the amount you would have taken. So taking an RMD is generally considered to be a good idea, but you still have to pay taxes on it. In this case, you've got a 28% tax burden on pulling it out. So now I've kind of laid what you already said in a very, very, we understood what you said, but now the listeners have.
You must have a pretty good income from other sources then, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, congratulations. You're rich.
Yes, and unfortunately, it pushes my soul to have to pay that 28% on that money that I worked so hard to build up in that self-directed IRA.
It's called recycling.
Yeah, the government said you don't have to pay taxes on it until we say you do, and they've said you do.
The government giveth and the government taketh away.
Right.
Right. Go ahead. Yes,
more,
sir.
More
go ahead.
Taketh than
and
giveth.
What about your 28% that you got to pay?
I have heard on a radio advertisement that there is something called an annuity which you can roll your RMD into that will negate that tax.
No.
Is that true?
No.
What they're talking about is if you take a lump sum, if you roll over a big chunk of your IRA into, it's still an IRA and an annuity, and you start taking an annuitization, which means now the insurance company owns your money and you get a stream of income. Part of that stream of income is taxable and part of it isn't.
Right.
Now, that's where they say it's a better deal. But the problem is that you've got a self-directed IRA. It sounds like you've been managing it well, and you have, at that point, have signed it all off to an insurance company.
The issue with using the fixed annuity is it spreads. In other words, you can't be forced to take out money faster than the annuity will pay you. The The problem with that, in the whole logic behind the fact that they can't make you take an RMD faster than the annuity company is paying you the money, is because it ain't your money anymore. So it's that same story of the old real estate limited partnerships, which you sound like you've been around long enough to remember, or the yep. the real estate investment trust non-traded, or any of the other sneaky tax dealies that are always bad.
It's great rule of thumb. There aren't that many. Don't get involved in an investment to make money that's based on a tax scheme, because right. you will lose money. That's how you save money in taxes, is losing money.
For starters, over a long period of time, that annuity that they'd be paying out to you is based on probably a 3% or lower rate of return. So, yeah, you can lower your taxes by not making any money.
That's the common approach to saving on taxes.
Number two, you have relieved yourself of ownership of the money and denied yourself the ability to take a lump sum for anything. And here's the biggie. I don't know how old you are, but let's just say you're
70.
You're
70. Coming up on 70.
Let's just say that you take an annuity and you expect it to last you for another 20 years, which is not unusual. If you'll think about the fact that the life insurance company that now owns your annuity, they are the owners, not you. And you think about corporations that have failed over the last 20 years, how many corporations have failed? Go back and look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average 20 years ago and look at it today, and some of the companies that are in the Dow Jones Industrial Average just flat don't exist anymore. And they were the highest rated companies in the nation at the time.
Good companies fail.
And the fact that as recently as 2009, most of the major annuity issuing companies in the United States were within hours of bankruptcy when the TARP bill was used to bail them out.
Now, let's come about this from the other direction. This is the way that I like to look at investing. If you don't need the money to live on, it doesn't sound like you do at this point, then you should take the money, pay taxes on it, and invest it again.
Right.
Because then the government doesn't have any restrictions on that money that you have inside there. It's all principal now that you've reinvested. It's all your money. When you look at your self-directed IRA, a big chunk of that money isn't yours still. A big chunk of that money still belongs to the U.S. Mm-hmm. government because you haven't paid taxes on it yet. As soon as you pay taxes on it, it's yours. And if you take that money and you take it out during the RMD, I don't recommend you taking money out to put yourself in a higher tax bracket. But you have an RMD. You're required to take that money out. Do something wise with it. First, you pay the taxes. And the good thing about paying taxes means you made money. Nobody likes to pay taxes. I don't know of anybody that likes to pay taxes. There may be somebody out there that thinks it's their patriotic. I think it's my patriotic duty, but I still don't like it. And when you pay taxes, then you at least know that the money that's left is yours. And there's other things that you can do with that money. If you have earned income right now, you can turn around and put it into a Roth, which means it will never be taxed again. At your age,
can't put it into a Roth unless you've got earned income.
That's what I just said. Okay, if you've got other earned income.
Right. I'm sorry.
Unfortunately, my earned income's been so high, I haven't been able to even contribute to my Roth in the last 5 years.
Well,
there are certain prices we have to pay.
Yep.
For being in the upper, you obviously are in the upper about 3% of the nation.
Yeah, you are definitely, as the Democrats like to say, paying your fair share.
Fair share. Say it through your nose. Yes. Fair share.
Fair share is right. Not so fair for those that have to pay it.
You didn't
compared
build
to those that.
That.
Yeah, you didn't build that. but we feel.
I just heard that advertisement that these folks were putting out that you can roll that RMD directly into this annuity and not have to pay the tax on it. That didn't make sense.
Yeah, well, you don't actually roll the RMD into it. You have to roll the IRA into it, and then the RMD that you take out is lessened. So you still have to take an RMD.
It's really simple. If you are willing to give up your money and have somebody own it that may not be there all that long and may not be able to pay you back when they go bankrupt, you can lower your taxes.
That makes
sense. And anytime somebody comes out, the tax code, the 1986 tax code, which we're under now in its convolutions, was designed very, very carefully in such a manner as to negate the value of tax shelters. And so anybody who comes out with a tax shelter plan or idea, it generally involves that you don't pay as much taxes on money if you lose money as you do if you make money.
So
you can lose a lot of money and you'll lower your taxes. So I don't think it's worth it, though.
Yeah.
Okay?
I agree.
Okay.
Thanks for the calling.
Thank you very much.
That is a rule, folks. Never, ever, ever. It's one of the very few never, ever, ever rules. Never, ever, ever make an investment for the purpose of avoiding taxes.
If the IRS doesn't get you on it, you will.
Yeah. At 401k, yes, you're deferring taxes. That's a different animal.
Yeah.
If you could figure some way, though, that somebody tells you this is a tax avoidance or tax... Well, the difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion is pretty small, let me tell you.
It's time and Leavenworth. That's the difference.
And it's sort of like alternative investments. And the problem with alternative investments is it's a really good way to lose money.
Yeah. Now, I had another thing I wanted to bring up, bitcoins. It's something that I have talked about a bit.
A bit?
See what I did. I did a joke.
You made a pun, but we're almost out of time, so you better talk fast.
Right. So bitcoins they made a big splash this last year and the year before. People were talking, they were up to $1,000 per bitcoin.
What are they at now?
315.
Oh, only a 70% loss?
That's all.
Well, that's not as bad as gold.
Well,
it's better than gold.
It is better than gold. It's a worse drop than gold. It's 70% is huge. So... I mean, I talked about this before, and this is something. Bitcoins
should buy dinars instead.
Oh man, that bitcoins are not quite a scam. Dinars are a scam, and this is one that's been going around. Basically, when you buy the Iraqi dinar because of some super secret government deal that's going to pay off, I've heard this scam going for 10 years now, and it's always the next week or so that the U.S. government's going to bail the Iraqis out. 10 years of this scam. And it's still going. When you're buying dinars, you have to think, who's selling them? Please.
ISIS.
Please. Who has the largest supply of dinars right now?
ISIS.
It's the Islamic State that you're buying from. The reason why I know this is when you go around to try to sell them back, which is what most people would want to do if they were going to make money in a deal. Well, this is the scam where the dinar is worth very little now. If you buy a whole bunch, then at the end of 2 weeks or 1 day or 3 days or whatever the magic number is in your particular scam, the U.S. government's going to bail out the Iraqis. They're going to make it the same as a dollar, and you're going to make hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars overnight. It's going to be magical. Well, here's the problem. If you get those dinars and you try to sell them, the U.S. government limits you. They say you cannot sell those because selling them is one of the currencies that is protected by the Department of Homeland Security because it's been flagged as funding for terrorism. You cannot sell a dinar. You can put it on your wall. You can look at it. You can hold it. But you can't sell it back.
And the other thing is you are effectively supporting ISIS when you buy dinars.
Yes.
Because they hold a lot of dinars right now.
And anybody that buys dinars raises the price of dinars, and their dinars are worth more, or more likely they're somehow involved in the sale to begin with. Mm. So avoid that. Avoid the Bitcoin. A Bitcoin is based on 256K encryption, which in 5 years will be old school encryption, which means any money that you put into it thinking this is going to be the new currency of the future is based on an encryption technology that's already starting to be replaced. So just keep that in mind. It's a cryptocurrency. It's based on technology, and technology, as most of us know, changes very quickly. And we're about out of time for this episode.
So if you would like to contact us, we have a voicemail over the weekend, and of course then during the week we have real live human beings. You can give us a call at 947-1111.
You can also reach that voicemail toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Or you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com,
where you can lower your IQ by listening to podcasts.
If you didn't lower your IQ enough by listening to this program,
right.
You can hear us jabber on into your ears, your headset, whatever you like, for as long as you like. We do not lay claim to any liability for your psychological expenses afterwards.
But you can also reach us either jeff@tpwc.com or
jake@tpwc.com.
So until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood. Proud to broadcast to the largest military post in the free world. News Radio 1400 KTEM.